as a consequence, his fellows believed him very well accomplished, and women, when they regarded him, believed him enigmatic and profound. He was not unhandsome, and his trade was a good one. He might have been considered a very eligible bachelor had he worked a little less and ventured into society a little more. But Pritchard loathed large groups of mixed company, where every man is required to act as a kind of envoy for his sex, and presents his own advantages playfully under the scrutiny of the room. Large crowds made him stifled and irritable. He preferred close company, and kept few friends, to whom he was fiercely loyal, as he was loyal to Anna, in his own way. The intimacy that he felt when he was with her owed chiefly to the fact that a man is never obliged to discuss his whores with other men. A whore is a private matter, a meal to be eaten alone. It was this aloneness that he sought in Anna. She was a solitude for him, and when he was with her, he kept her at a distance. Pritchard had truly loved only once in his life, but it had been 16 years since Mary Menzies became Mary Firkin and moved to Georgia to pursue a life of cotton and red earth and, so Pritchard had imagined, an expansive slowness made of wealth and cloudless skies. Whether she had perished, whether Mr. Firkin, too, was living still, whether she had children, born or lost, whether she had aged well or aged badly, he did not know. She was Mary Menzies, in his mind. When he had last seen her, she had been 25, dressed simply in sprigged muslin, with her hair gathered in ringlets at her temples, her wrists and fingers unadorned. They were sitting in the window box, saying goodbye. "Joseph," she had said. He inscribed it in his pocketbook later, to remember it for all of time. "Joseph, I don't believe you have ever been at peace with good. It is well you never made love to me. You will remember me fondly now. It would not have been so otherwise." He heard quick steps on the other side of the door. "Oh, it's you," was Anna's only greeting. She was disappointed. She must have been expecting someone else. Pritchard stepped inside without speaking and closed the door behind him. Anna moved into the quartered patch of light beneath the window. She was dressed in mourning, but by the old-fashioned style of the gown, the bell-shaped skirt, the pointed waist, and the faded hue of the cloth, Pritchard guessed it had not been tailored for her new. It must have been a gift, or more likely something salvaged. He saw that the hem had been let out. 2 inches of darker black showed as a stripe against the floor. It was a strange thing to behold a whore in mourning, rather like seeing a dandified cleric or a child with a moustache. It gave one a sense of confusion, Pritchard thought. It struck him that he had rarely seen Anna except by lamplight or by the moon. Her complexion was translucent, even blue, and tended to a deep purple beneath her eyes, as if she had been painted in watercolour on a paper that was not stiff enough to hold the moisture so the colours ran. Her countenance was, as Pritchard's mother might have said, made up of angles. Her brow was very straight, and her chin was pointed. Her nose was narrow, even geometric. A sculptor might render it in 4 strokes, with 1 slice on either side, 1 down the bridge and 1 tuck beneath. She was thin-lipped, and though her eyes were naturally large, she tended to peer upon the world suspiciously, and so rarely employed them to seductive effect. Her cheeks were hollow, and her jawbone was visible, as the rim of a drum is visible, tight beneath the stretched membrane of the skin. The previous year she had been with child, a state that had warmed the wax of her cheeks and made plump the wretched bones of her arms, and Pritchard had liked her. The round belly, the swollen breasts, hidden beneath yards of lawn and tulle, fabrics which softened her, made her buoyant. But sometime after the spring equinox, when the evenings were becoming longer and the days brighter, and the sun hung low and scarlet over the Tasman Sea for hours before slipping finally into the red wash of the sea, the baby perished. Its body had since been wrapped in calico and buried in a shallow grave upon the terrace at Sea View. Pritchard had not spoken to Anna about the baby's death. He did not frequent her rooms with any kind of regularity, and he did not ask her questions when he was there. but he had wept privately when he heard the news. There were so few children in Hokitika, perhaps 3 or 4. One looked forward to seeing them as to hearing a familiar accent of speech, or a beloved ship on the horizon, that put one in mind of home. He waited for her to speak first.
"You can't stay," she said. "I've an appointment."
"I won't keep you. I wanted to ask after your health."
"Oh," she burst out, "I am sick of the question, sick of it."
He was surprised by the violence of her answer. "I haven't visited you in a while."
"No."
"But I saw you in the thoroughfare, just after the New Year."
"It's a small town."
He moved closer. "You smell like the sea."
"I don't. I haven't been sea-bathing in weeks."
"Something stormy, then, as when a body comes in from the snow and carries in the cold."
"What are you doing?"
"What am I doing?"
"By speaking in that way. Poetical."
"Poetical?" Pritchard had the bad habit, when conversing with women, of answering a question with another question. Mary Menzies had complained of it once, long ago.
"Sentimental. Fanciful, I don't know, it doesn't matter."
Anna plucked at her cuff.
"I have recovered my health," she added, "and you can save your next question for yourself. I didn't mean any kind of unnatural harm. I meant to take a pipe, same as always, and then I fell asleep. And the next thing I remember, I was in jail."
Pritchard placed his hat upon the armoire. "And since then, you've been hounded."
"To death."
"Poor you."
"Sympathy is worse."
"Well then," Pritchard said, "I shan't give you any. I'll be cruel to you instead."
"I don't care."
It seemed to him that she spoke with pity and blankness, which angered him. He considered showing it, but then he reminded himself that he was on an errand. "Who's the client?" he said instead, to taunt her. She had gone to the window and half turned in surprise.
"What?"
"You said you've an appointment. Who is it?"
"There's no client. I'm going with a lady to look at hats."
He snorted. "I've heard of a whore's honour, you know. You don't have to lie." She studied him from what seemed like a great distance, as if he were only a mark on the horizon for her, a distant speck receding. And then she said slowly, as if speaking to a child,
"Of course. You didn't know. I'm done with whoring for a time."
He raised his eyebrows, and then to cover his surprise,